welcome to this podcast series on the Beethoven String Quartets, brought to you by the Mokum Symphony. I'm your host, Emlyn Stamm, and I'll be taking you through Beethoven String Quartets in this five-episode series, focusing on what's special about each and every one of them. Today we're also going to talk about the importance of Beethoven in our contemporary culture, and have a bit of a look at the approach that the Mokum String Quartet is taking to performing these pieces. So here to join me for this discussion is composer, conductor, violinist, and artistic director of the Mokum Symphony, Johan Berkhamer. Welcome, Johan.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start off today by having a look at what Beethoven means to us in our current culture. Why is Beethoven important today? Why should we perform, explore, and listen to his music? Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, that's a difficult question because Beethoven represents so much greatness and so much depth and so much humanity, and his compositions are transcendental. It contains the oldest music and it contains the music of the future. So he oversees the whole musical culture of humanity, and we can learn from him in every bar.
And he's kind of the iconic Western composer, right, of Western music. So I guess this also comes to the question that many people are discussing in literature and other fields. Does the Western canon matter, and should we defend it? Like, is Shakespeare worth continuing to do and study? And there's a lot of criticism coming from academics and authors. For example, a musicologist in New York, Philip Ewell, said that Beethoven was an above-average composer promoted by whiteness and maleness.
Wonderful.
So that therefore somehow because white men or, you know, European Western artists and musicians wrote the music they did, we should somehow no longer continue to celebrate them because they're somehow excluding other voices. What would you say to that point of view?
Let's get rid of him.
Philip Ewell, you mean?
No, Beethoven.
Oh, Beethoven. That's what Philip Ewell is saying, get rid of Beethoven.
Exactly. It's what the Beatles were singing, Roll Over Beethoven.
That was not the Beatles, that was Chuck Berry.
Chuck Berry, sure. That's true.
That's actually the first rock and roll record ever made.
Is that so?
Yeah, it's quite cool.
Well, I'm gonna write a little letter, I'm gonna mail it to my local DJ. Yeah, it's a jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today.
Anyway, Beethoven had the boogie-woogie in his music. We were thinking of the last piano sonata, opus 111. So the broadness of his music doesn't stop, well, so-called classical music. This has a broader grip. We say in Holland, hoge bomen vangen veel wind. So high trees catch a lot of wind. And it's quite logical that Beethoven gets some criticism. And in his time, he had a hard time with all the criticisms he had to encounter.
So people found his music too unnecessarily complicated back then.
Yes, there was a review of his third symphony. Mr. Beethoven took us on a beautiful walk in the woods, but after 20 seconds we got stuck into the braamstruiken. What is that in English?
Blackberry thistles.
Yeah.
Just to come back to this Philip Ewell, it's so interesting because, for example, if you look at a black intellectual thinker like Dr. Cornel West, who's been a very prominent voice for the civil rights movement in the United States for many years, he says Beethoven is the original blues man because he took the suffering that he experienced in his life, being deaf, the suffering of the world, and he turned that and he made that expressed in music. And he says blues is, you know, the suffering of African Americans in slavery expressed musically.
Oh, you remember what Beethoven said on his deathbed, you know? He said, I've learned to look at the world in all of its darkness and evil and still love it. And that's not romantic Beethoven. This is the Beethoven of the string quartets, of 1-3-1, the greatest string quartet ever written, not just in classical music, but of course it's European forms. Beethoven is the grand master. But string quartets, you go back to those movements, there's no romantic wholeness to be shattered as in early Beethoven. He's given up on that, you see. This is where Chekhov begins. This is where the blues starts. This is where jazz starts. You think Charlie Parker's upset because he can't sustain a harmony? He doesn't care about the harmony. He's trying to completely ride on the dissonance, ride on the blue notes.
Right, so maybe we should listen to Cornel West and not other academics who think that they're so clever that they need to destroy the Western canon.
I completely agree.
The blues, my kind of blues, begins with catastrophe. It begins with the angel of history and Benjamin's thesis. You see, it begins with the pile of wreckage on one pile on another. That's the starting point. The blues is personal catastrophe lyrically expressed.
And of course, you also have in this debate in literature, I don't know, did you know Harold Bloom, the literary critic?
No.
Harold Bloom has been arguing about this since the 60s, 70s, and 80s. All these people attacking the canon, saying, oh yeah, but there's so many white male authors and it's not whatever. Mm-hmm. His argument has always been, we have to look at depth and quality of writing, and we really shouldn't care per se who has done the writing, but Shakespeare speaks to everybody, regardless of your gender or your background. His stories have that universality. And I think Beethoven's music also has that universality that we should fight for it and embrace it.
But it's not such a big... There are not so many people that believe this. So we shouldn't worry.
You also had a musicologist called Andrea Moore who said that Beethoven's music should be banned in 2020 because of his 250th anniversary of his birth, and that all performances of his music should be replaced with contemporary compositions.
I have no words for that.
I mean, I would say your contemporary compositions wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Beethoven, first of all, right?
Yeah.
I mean...
No, Beethoven's music is timeless. I mean, there's no limit.
Let's move on and talk a little bit about the Mokum String Quartet's approach to performing Beethoven in this cycle that we're doing. What can you say about our approach in learning these pieces and playing them, which is unconventional? I know we talked a lot about early recordings in the last episode. What has been our own approach so far?
Well, the general approach of today's musicians is they look forward. I mean, when you start playing a piece, you start at the beginning and you play towards the end. And the end is somewhere in the future, maybe 22 minutes away. So we know how to look forward. So I think that's the reason why so little musicians look backward. I mean, if we look at the first historical recordings, there's so much to learn. Because in those days, in let's say 1890 until 1935, there were people recording whose teachers studied with contemporaries of Beethoven. So the connection between musicians in that era to Beethoven is really close, although we difference in age a lot in the quartet. There's a big difference in age, but...
What is that difference? Do you want to explain?
Well, I was born in 51, and you guys are much younger, right?
Yeah, somewhere in the 80s.
Yeah.
So I guess you were born with Doris Day, and we grew up with Michael Jackson. So it's irreconcilable culturally, right?
Yes.
And musically.
Night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sky. Are you walking? Are you walking, Annie? Are you walking? Are you doing this? Are you walking? The sound of the window.
It's a wonder that we could even contemplate playing together.
Yeah, it's true. It's a miracle. But it tells us more about you than me, because I never changed my playing. I mean, I remember that my first recital in the Concertgebouw Hall, I played Beethoven Sonata number 6, and the review said it was nice playing of this young violinist, but why did he need so much time, rubato, you know? Why did he change the tempo all the time? And it was just my nature. And I've never stopped doing it.
Yeah. But your father was also an artist, right?
Yes. So my father was, when he was 40, he became sculptor. But before that, he was a one-man actor. I mean, he was a declamator, as we said. He had, his repertoire was the Bible, all the books of the Bible, and fairy tales of Grimm and Andersen. And
toen zei de Saul tot Samuel, ik heb gezondigd, omdat ik des Heeren bevel en uw woorden overtreden heb, want ik heb het volk gevreesd. And have naar hun stem gehoord. Nu dan.
From him I learned to...
Rhetoric, right?
Yeah, rhetoric.
How to tell a story.
Exactly.
In music.
Yes.
So maybe that your playing has that rhetorical history somehow from your family.
I think already. So. I think it's a strong influence.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because we can hear, for example, when you're a kid, you're playing the Dvořák Romance with the Concertgebouw Orchestra, right?
Yes.
As a soloist. And it also sounds very declamated, and you're doing a lot of pushing and pulling of the tempo and very singing kind of playing, which is, yeah, was somehow sounded more historical than its time in the late 60s.
It's just my musical nature. I think I have a lyrical musical nature. It's just like that. And when I play now Beethoven with you guys, I do nothing funny or nothing awkward or unnatural. But I've always listened to old recordings. When I was a student, I was the only one listening to Kreisler and Caruso and Frédéric Lamont and other great people from that era. And I remember we had parties and I played records and my colleagues were flabbergasted. And most of them thought it was all too sentimental and they all said, well, we are much further now.
The myth of progress, that we've somehow been getting better and better with time. It's funny because the three of us who play with you in the quartet, we of course grew up, like I said, with Michael Jackson, and we listened to really great modern musicians growing up, like Yo-Yo Ma and Pinchas Zukerman and Itzhak Perlman and Emmanuel Axe and these type of great players.
Yes.
And we went to school in the conservatory and we were all told to practice with metronome and to, you know, do all the things that you're supposed to do to be a modern musician. And I think somewhere in school we all started listening to historical recordings and started reading about them and going, wait a second, but we don't have to play like this if we don't want, because this isn't the way that musicians always played this music, so it doesn't have to be the way we all play the music in the future. And then of course fast forward a few years and a bunch of events in between where I, you know, had an orchestra job and left and did other things and then started working on my dissertation studying these early recordings. And then we did this experiment with the reenactment, with copying the historical recordings, right?
Yes.
So what do you think copying those quartet recordings by the Klingler Quartet, by the Brüder Post Quartet, the Bohemian String Quartet, what do you think that gave us in our playing?
It gave sort of a mirror, because it mirrors different worlds. It mirrors the world where the original recordings were recorded. And it mirrors also your own soul, because you have to get used to things. You have to make things your own. And you have to weigh if you're telling the truth, because it's all a matter of being honest and being fair. Like in daily life, I know exactly when I'm doing something for the effect or something to impress people, you know, with technique. I know exactly when I'm being honest or not with music.
So it's a matter of also integrating those techniques, like the constant movement of tempo,
the slides, the connections.
Slides, not playing precisely together, but playing kind of in layers of independent voices and changing the rhythms and these kind of aspects, like not only just learning them, but also making them your own way of communicating so that you can really tell the story as if it's your own at the same time.
Exactly.
Thank you. Yeah, and you're of course a very spiritual person. At least you really believe in a kind of a divine truth when it comes to playing music this way.
Yes, I think the audience recognized that too. I think there are so many, many wonderful, true ways to perform music. And that's also the interesting aspect of our quartet, because we are four individuals. We use our own bowings. We use our own phrasing even in themes. Well, we have the same theme. So we keep our identity alive. And all of us are playing honestly.
Or at least we try to.
Yes, I mean, even if you fail, you're honest.
And then perhaps in a way you could say an honest failure is more interesting than a perfectly polished performance, which may be a polished turd of untruth.
Yes, exactly. and the truths are not, it's not something that it's not the intuition thing, it's just studying the harmonic development and the form of the music. I mean, it's not a random thing, let's get inspired and play very true from my own emotions. No, it's looking at the music and studying it, and putting time in it, into it.
At the same time, we sometimes play against the structure of the music, doing things like blurring the boundary of the recapitulation or making certain things unclear, which might be clear on paper, on purpose.
We take freedoms and experiment all the time. I think normal modern quartets spend like 80 or maybe even 90% of their time playing together perfectly without mistakes. We don't do that. We spend almost all the time to create the music in terms of freedoms that we allow ourselves,
yeah.
Searching for them.
But the freedom is also about, maybe it's coming back to this thing we talked about with the rhetoric and your father being a voice actor or a rhetorician. That it's also the freedom is about saying something. It's about really making a character come alive in sound, right?
Yes.
It's not just freedom for freedom's sake, but it's because you want to say something with the freedom that you couldn't say if you didn't free yourself from the bar lines on the page and the literalness of the score.
Exactly.
You're also a composer, right? So how do you think about this? You write music. So if you've written a piece, surely you don't expect that somehow the performance has to just literally follow the score. I mean, surely the piece is only a beginning.
Yes, I had a wonderful experience once with my piano trio I wrote in 2000. We played that a lot. And at a certain moment, our pianist got ill and we needed to find another one. We found a wonderful Spanish pianist, Patricia de la Vega. And we played the trio. We played the trio already many times. So for her, it was new. And immediately she had ideas and gave suggestions for the performance.
Yeah. And that, you're the composer playing
yes.
with her. And she said, hey, but how about this? How about
yeah.
that?
And that really surprised me. And that really struck me. And she was so right. I mean, she had beautiful ideas. That was a great lesson for me.
As a composer and a performer,
yes.
I think.
Yes, yeah. Especially as a composer. Like a mother who puts her child...
Or like orphans her child.
Yeah, that's what a composer does.
Right, so it can really go wrong with the development of your child.
Absolutely.
But it's true, in some sense, the notes on the paper are really the beginning of something. You wouldn't say that Shakespeare's script of Hamlet or Romeo and Juliet is a performance of the play, you know? The performance of the play comes with the costumes and the actors and the staging and the lighting. And what the musicians do when they play a piece of Beethoven is they're doing the costumes and the interpretation and the voice and the lighting and the stage. We are setting all of that, you know, whereas what Beethoven has given us is a script, for example.
Right. You can't go into the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam and for the night watch from Rembrandt, you can't say, well, this red is a bit too light, let's darken it.
There's been a discussion, actually, in art restoration. I came across this reading about this in music, right? Because there's all these early music people who said, yeah, but if you vibrate during Bach, it's like putting too much red on the Rembrandt, like you're saying, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's how they claim it.
Yeah.
It's like, but of course, one has nothing to do with another, because we're talking about the written music is really kind of a script on top of which a play is built, and that's not the same as a painting.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, I came across this discussion in the art restoration world that they were discussing. I can't remember, it was a 16th century Italian painter who was famous for his red color, which was a vibrant red. And they tried to restore the original red on an older painting of his to his color, and they found it to be too pink or something like that. So they said, maybe we should make it more red because modern viewers expect it to be a stronger red. So perhaps we have to. They're also talking about what is the right red. Is this really the red he wanted? Maybe it has to be stronger. Even there, it's not at all a cut and dry, you know, thing.
Yeah.
So goes to show you. Anyway, whoever says that using vibrato in Bach is like painting extra red on Rembrandt is an idiot and you should never listen to them.
Well, you know, there's this first violin virtuoso known in this world. It's Federico Rognoni. And in 1620, mind you, he wrote a treatise on violin playing, and there was a chapter, vibrato. The violinist should vibrate on every note to touch the soul of the listener.
Yeah.
And if the music is very emotional, the finger is allowed to leave its place. So,
yeah.
It's 1620.
Actually, it's like these Wilhelmier rolls, the wax roll recording that's attributed to August Wilhelmier, where he plays Paganini. He does that kind of crazy vibrato.
Absolutely, yes.
And it's also interesting because I was talking about this with a very renowned traverso player who's a specialist in 18th century music or whatever. And he was also looking at some of these treatises and he was saying they're starting to conclude that it seems like from the treatises and the texts that probably there was a lot of vibrato used in the 17th and 16th centuries.
Yes.
And that somehow in the 18th century, they maybe started to use it less than before, which is bizarre. So that would mean that like Vivaldi and Monteverdi and that type of music, they might have used way more vibrato, and then for maybe later composers like Bach or Handel, maybe a bit less or something, which is completely turning upside down our understanding in that field. They somehow have brainwashed us that the further back in time you go, the more clean the performances were and everything was, you know, perfect and whatever. And that suddenly in the 19th century, everyone was corrupted and started to vibrate. That's what Harnoncourt says. Oh, the French Revolution changed everything. But Harnoncourt is completely wrong, because we lived through 9/11, you lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis. Of course, things change, but it doesn't change overnight. Like, oh, the French Revolution, suddenly we use vibrato, or suddenly we play with rubato, and before everyone played perfectly in time.
Yeah.
It's completely nonsense.
Yes.
It wasn't like September 12th, 2001, suddenly the world was, okay, things changed, you know, in some kind of fundamental way in history, and events follow each other, but change is very gradual and generational, and it's nonsense to say that
one day,
1 year changed everything.
Absolutely. Apart from that, I think in the older times, the vibrato, if you listen to the old singers, so much difference in personality and vibrato. Some vibrate very fast, some very slow, some almost nothing, almost not. I think instrumental sense, the vibrato was different in cities and villages. I mean, traditions in countries in...
A rich variety, yeah. So like Salzburg and Vienna would have different vibratos or something, or different singing.
If you hear the 1910 performances of the Berlin Philharmonic, you don't hear much vibrato.
Yeah.
If you hear Joseph Joachim, he didn't use a big oscillation.
Yeah.
He vibrated very narrow. It was all about the phrasing and the intonation.
And the rhythmic freedom.
Made him wonderful.
I mean, if you do this horror of taking away the vibrato and also all of the rubato and all of the phrasing, like many period players do, then you get this absolute non-entity, non-communicating performance.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on and talk about the third of the five programs in the Beethoven cycle. This program has the Opus 18 number 4 quartet in C minor, the Opus 74 quartet, known as the harp, and the Opus 132 quartet in A minor. So let's talk about the Opus 18 4 quartet in C minor. So C minor and Beethoven, Fifth Symphony. Kind of iconic key, right?
Pathétique
sonata.
Yes, it's always, to me, it's sort of the key of the fate. Dramatic fate that was awaiting him. There's always a lot of passion and going forward, all very dramatic. And also this quartet, number 4, opus 18, is already loose from the Haydnesque quartets, number 1, and 2, and 3, in terms of ideas and...
The first movement is definitely stormy, you know, with those heavy fortissimo chords and those kind of accents everywhere.
Yeah, and it was a big revelation to hear the Rosé Quartet.
Of Arnold Rosé.
Yeah, it's my favorite performance because the accents that they give are not really but more like an outburst of emotion.
And there's a lot of rhetoric in that performance, right? Like, bum, beam, ba, 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 pee, da, deem, de, la, lum, beam. It's the tempo is always shifting gears all the time.
And then the loveliness of the second theme. With the glissandi. Like singing. Against the drama around it. Yes, it's an amazing work.
And the second movement is then in C major.
Yes.
So it's the contrast to the major, and then it's this light kind of music that you think, oh, it's very trivial, but it's actually a very kind of serious fugue in four voices at the same time as being a kind of light and funny allegro.
Yes.
It's almost, I would say that's almost Mozartian, to sort of, to write a complex polyphonic piece with all voices talking to each other and imitating each other, but at the same time it's light and it's funny and it's sort of just off the cuff of your sleeve, you know?
Yes, exactly.
Sort of, he just sort of wrote it.
Yes. Also here, it is so, it gives so much freedom if you use a little rubato in the timing, because you know the normal modern ways would be yum pim 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 ta 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 pim 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 pim. So what we do and what we stole from Rosé is dum pum pim pim ya ta 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 pim 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 pim, like.
And the problem that, of course, is that, or not the problem, but what happens is that everybody is doing a rubato like that, but then the voices are on top of each other. So you end up really not together.
Yes. That's so freeing.
The revelation there is actually, in a way, when you play like that, the listener hears more of the polyphony because the voices
exactly.
are independent from each other. Whereas if you line them up, then you start to only hear, let's say, one of the voices, which is the loudest or whatever. But here you're suddenly like, oh, there's a lot happening. Oh, it's very dense texture.
Yes.
And then the third movement of this piece, which is a minuet, seems to be a very traditional like minuet with this kind of drone.
Yeah.
Almost like a folk drone, especially the way the Rosé Quartet plays it. It's kind of, it's almost like a barrel organ or something.
Absolutely.
You know, with these accents on the third beat. You know?
Yeah.
And then you have the trio, which is then in the major, where finally he writes a theme for the viola and the second violin, and the first violin is playing the triplets.
Yes, the triplets are one of those amazing moments to perform them. It's very simple arpeggios. Simple. And he wants to and then. And it's so wonderful to play that.
In the violin, second violin and viola, sounds like a Viennese Ländler or an Austrian Ländler or something. So the last movement, when we think of the last movement of 18-4, I always think there's something very Hungarian about it, you know, or Hungarian gypsy or something about this, about this violin melody.
Well, it is, it reminds us of the piano trio of Haydn.
That's the one that they call the Gypsy Trio, right?
Yes. So it's exactly the same.
Fantastic. I hadn't even thought of that.
From G major to C minor.
So this folk thing coming into Beethoven here in the last movement of the C minor. this kind of gypsy folk thing.
Yes, and so he has this Haydn-esque motif that a little and ends up in so repetition of the G is from the scherzo. So I think all those movements are connected, not only the movements of the quartets, but of all the quartets are connected. You can find all kinds of quoting, not only himself, but also other composers.
So Beethoven actually is reusing, or not reusing, but referring to his own material.
Yes.
That's probably one of the great reasons to actually go and listen to a Beethoven cycle, because you'll find all these cross connections and developments between the pieces.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then the harp quartet. That's an interesting one, because actually, we were just talking about Beethoven quoting himself. If you look at the third movement of the Opus 131 quartet in C sharp minor, which we talked about last time, there's a little snippet in the adagio there for the viola, which is the theme of the harp quartet.
Ah, yes. Dee-da-da-dee-da-da. Yeah.
So he's quoting that in the 131 and then rejecting it and going on to something else. But this quartet, so first of all, why is it called the harp?
Well, because in the first movement there are pizzicati.
Plucked strings.
Yes, so not with a bow, but with a finger, like a guitar. And if you press your left hand, if you press your left fingers on the string, it resonates. So it sounds really like a harp. So that's why it's called a harp. And it's quite wonderful how he uses it, of course, the pizzicato. And the other strings have pum 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 with a bow and tung tung tung. So it's a great effect. But I think this work is so has such a strong inner world, like the outgoing quartet we just spoke about, Opus 8, number 4, the passionate C minor with monumental chords and accents. And this work, Opus 74, is so the most beautiful inner world that you can imagine. It's actually one of my, I can't say that I have favorite quartets, but I love this quartet deeply because of the incredible inner civilization that you hear and loveliness.
Especially in the incredible opening adagio, where he's cycling through different harmonies, dissonant harmonies, and suddenly you come out in this major theme, which is just a rising arpeggio. We talked a lot about how simple his themes are, but you can't get more simple than beam, bom, beam, right?
Absolutely.
And there's something, he's going up, it's very, very sunny, very positive all of a sudden. Favorite parts of the first movement is that incredible section where the melody goes into the second violin near the end and the first violin is playing those arpeggios. It's such an incredibly optimistic thing because the theme is rising and rising and it's this long melody and there's this driving 16th notes going through.
Yes, it's very demanding, very difficult. You really need all your energy for that moment, and it's very exciting to perform it. Every time we rehearse it, it's like really exciting.
It's really terrific because for those of you that love cinema, Jean-Luc Godard uses this passage during a bank robbery in the movie Prenum Carmen. So whenever I hear it, I also imagine those guys with the balaclavas and the guns shooting in the bank. It's really something. But yeah, it's incredible music.
Yeah, a quartet is rehearsing in the bank, huh?
Yeah, the quartet is. And there's these guys with the guns. It's really something. And then the second movement of this quartet is really I mean, it's a long lyrical movement.
Yes. And what you see in the piano sonatas so often is that the wideness of the two hands being apart, left hand low, right hand high, in the high registers of the piano. You have that here too.
The cello and the viola are really low.
Yeah, in A flat major low and the violin high up on the E string.
Yeah.
There's a strange gap. It gives me always sort of trouble because I don't know what sort of, if I really use an E string sound, a bit sharp, I have to avoid that because then it sounds odd. But if I play too vague on the E string, it sounds weak. So the solution is to play really with introvert sound and expression. It's very demanding.
And this movement also has a second theme, which again goes into minor.
It's very sad.
It's really one of the most beautiful movements, I think, from the whole cycle, the second of the of the harp. Really singing and just lovely. And then there's the third movement. And I think that third movement, again, we're in C minor, and this takes us right into the Fifth Symphony, because the motive is the same, three shorts and a long, pa-pa-pa-pam, pa-pa-pa-pam, right?
Yes. Fate. And what I love about it is that we spoke before about Beethoven being ahead of his time. So after a few bars, he enters completely the world of Mendelssohn. Now this one. It's like the Midsummer Night Dream. There he had Mendelssohn in his pocket, as he had Brahms in his pocket in the last movement.
Yeah. And it's so much like the Fifth Symphony also with the, it goes suddenly again to C major. You have a kind of trio section, really quick, but fugal with all kinds of entrances, just like the Fifth Symphony. Scherzo, then you have the trio, then you have the scherzo, then you have the trio, then the scherzo.
Yeah.
And it's really different, it's like, I guess, from the Fifth Symphony in the likeness as well.
Yeah, it's sort of, he has that often, a sort of obsession that he doesn't stop and keeps repeating, like a feverish dream.
And then what's wonderful is the end of that scherzo, how he's doing this motive. Ah. That motive becomes Schubert's Quartettsatz.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Schubert takes that and makes the most wonderful little piece out of it, which I guess he couldn't finish. He again, must have got stuck in this Beethoven obsession. And then this trails off, right? And then suddenly we're in the last movement, which is this very friendly, very kind of happy, very traditionally shaped variation movement, as if nothing happened in all of these movements.
But before. There's something a little bit funny
in
the beginning, because it is as if the beat is on the dee-da-dum, 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 but the beat is dee-da-dum, dee-da-dum, so it's upbeat. Yeah. It doesn't sound like an upbeat. So what should you do?
It's something Brahms did a lot.
Yes. And speaking about Brahms, in the variation, the cello is and then we enter Brahms' world. Especially. The harmony development, harmonic development, and the whole use of the instrumentation is completely Brahms.
And what to make of the sudden dash to the end, at the end of the last movement of Opus 74. All of a sudden it just wraps up and goes speeding to the end in a really happy unison. I always wonder if he's just sort of, with this movement, just sort of brushing everything off with a sense of humor, despite all of the drama and all of the kind of fate and lyricism and all of these strong things that happened in the previous movements.
Well, it's on purpose. It's not to get rid of it quickly for his next commission.
It's like confronting life with a sense of humor, perhaps.
Absolutely.
All right, let's talk about the last quartet on this program, the big sprawling Opus 132 in A minor. Interestingly, also about its historical reception, this quartet seems to have been the best received of the late quartets, and maybe the most easy to perform for musicians. Why do you think that it's perhaps more easy to understand and perform than 131 or 127, the other late
quartets? I don't know. I remember when I was a student, we sat together and you avoided the late quartets of Beethoven because they were too difficult to read, you know, with a glass of wine and a cigarette. And then suddenly I had a crazy idea. Let's read 132. I said, no, come on. No, let's do it. And then we did it and we managed to read it through without stop. I mean, in that sense, it's not the most difficult. And he wrote it quite quickly, you know.
So this quartet again starts with a slow introduction, a few bars, with these kind of intertwining chromatic motives.
The dissonance of Mozart.
It's again this idea from the Mozart dissonance comes in so many, also in the harp, right, in 59.3. And then suddenly we're in this descending scales in the violin, and then these motives in the rest of the quartet, the melody. Yeah, very lyrical very singing also movement.
You know, what I'm just realized is that when he writes in A minor, it is always accessible. For instance, the violin sonata,
yeah,
number 4. Second movement of the 7th symphony.
Yep.
Strong, simple, because and it's so great because it's so simple. Accessible.
Right. And then what to make of the second movement where everybody is playing in unison at the opening with this rising line in A major? It's almost like a return to a simple minuet, but it's not, right? Like the early Haydn quartets often have a lot of these kind of unison, everybody playing the same, like tutti.
Yes.
Right? And then here we have this kind of banal theme.
I have always pictures of a dance. I mean, when I play Bach partitas or sonatas, the dances, but I never think of dancing or other menuets. Dancing is not the first thing I think about, but here I do.
Something peasant-like also about the trio where you have that the kind of drone open A string, right? And you're way up high there. It's really like a country fiddler.
Yeah, it's breathtaking, that music. There is Paganini Capricci with some bagpipe D.
Yeah.
And Mozart with the G string.
Yeah.
That's number 4.
Yeah. The most legendary movement of this quartet has to be the Heiliger Dankgesang, as he called it.
Yes.
This hymn of thanks and praise to, he calls it the Gottheit, the deity, not even to God, but whatever that means, it's almost like he's in some kind of more ancient Greek feeling, and also using the Lydian mode, which of course is one of the Pythagorean modes.
Yes.
So he's...
It seems to be a healing mode. In the real old days, it was used to heal people.
Yep.
And you know, what struck me was that this rich businessman heard this quartet for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And he cried like a baby when he heard it.
Somebody you knew? Or?
No, Beethoven knew.
Oh, the Beethoven knew.
Yes, this was Mr. Wolfmeier. He was a businessman.
Textile manufacturer.
And that struck me when I read that, because I think the audiences were really open for... emotion.
Yeah.
When you read about audiences in London when they heard the first Haydn symphonies, the first time Haydn wrote this London symphonies, and the audience got crazy. They were standing on their chairs, screaming and yelling, and
like at a Michael Jackson concert.
Yes, absolutely. So this music is almost too deep to understand for us in 2020.
Yeah, and we have basically these themes interweaving through all the voices. It's very polyphonic, very fugal, let's say almost canon, I guess.
Yes, but in an abstract way. It has nothing to do anymore with classical music or Haydn-esque, Mozart-esque music. Thank you.
And then you get these middle sections where he writes Neue Kraft erfüllen.
The three dances in between, modern dances in between the...
Feeling new strength all of a sudden. And that's, I guess, supposed to represent his kind of recovery, that he was ill and then felt this new energy, and that's what allowed him to keep living. It's a remarkable story, really. Remarkable music. Indeed, like it's from a different world. And then after this long, slow movement, we go into this strange march all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's just happiness. It's love for life.
And then that suddenly breaks down into a recitativo, kind of very dramatic, where the first violin is playing this absolutely sung kind of outburst, while the rest is just playing a tremolo underneath, you know, like as in an opera. It's really remarkable.
Yes. Well, it reminds us of the Ninth Symphony, just before the Ode.
Yeah. Goes the opposite way. So if you're saying the march is happiness and recovery, then we have this outburst, and then we are back in this kind of crazy minor world in the last movement that we are kind of running from a demon or something. You know, it's.
I think it's a warning, like the 17th century painters,
Vanitas.
Yeah, they had warnings. They warned the viewer, and I think this is like a warning for you can be happy, you can be cured, but you never know what is happening tomorrow. It's like, watch out in the middle of the happiness.
And that last movement is also a kind of fear or anxiety, maybe.
Yeah, it's like running for something.
Running for your life, basically.
Yes. You can make pantomime or cartoon on this music, a figure that goes through hell and heaven.
Yeah, like Dante almost or something.
Yes.
Like the circles of, what is it, hell, and then he's ascending upwards. But in this case, we were kind of ascending upwards and then back down again.
But every time we rehearse this quartet or any other quartet, I really feel privileged that we do this for our living.
What you could say is some people go and work for Mark Zuckerberg every day at Facebook. We can go and work for an actual genius like Beethoven.
Yes.
All right, Johan. Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you as always.
Same.
And same. We hope you enjoyed this podcast and that you'll stay tuned for episodes 4 and 5.
Mm-hmm.